We're recording.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Walston. We are back on the record just after our very brief break. So at this point in the proceeding, the applicant was going to present. I believe Mr. Clayton Graham had stated that he was representing the applicant. Mr. Graham, are you online?
Yes, he should be coming over here in just a moment. Okay. And if there's anyone else in the attendee list that he'd like me to pull over, I can do that as well, just so they're kind of in the waiting. So.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Graham, just let us know if we need to pull anyone else up to the panel version, if you will. Do I need to swear you in, or are you presenting just legal argument?
You know, I'm presenting just legal for now. I do have one co-presenter whom we may as well swear in when he comes up, if that makes sense.
Okay. If you could just go ahead and state your name again for the record, then.
Great. Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks for the opportunity to present the project. We're happy to be here. My name is Clayton Graham, and I'm land use counsel to the owner applicant here. So I've only done a handful of these hearings by Zoom, so we'll try to keep it as efficient and engaging as possible. Before we started our presentation, I actually was hoping to just clear up a couple brief housekeeping matters with the examiner, and I think I know the answers to most of these questions, but just wanted to confirm. So I've actually got one co-presenter with me, John Rose, whom I'll introduce in a moment here. We've also got several project staff and consultants who are available to address any questions that may come up during the hearing. I can't see the other participants other than the panelists, but I'm assuming that we can loop others in if it's needed.
Yes, we can do that. And on kind of some of the technical issues, if you all wanted to, it might make sense to wait to hear public comment and see where the focus on that should be. That's up to you all on how to do that, but that might be the most efficient way.
And just for technical sake, there should be where you see panelists, you should have a spot that says attendees also off to the side that you should be able to click and view. So you can kind of toggle back and forth.
Got it. I see it. Thank you, Ms. Walton.
You're welcome.
Okay. And then on the record, and I know there were many emails being exchanged over the last day, but I wanted to make sure that the examiner had the most recent index of exhibits that we sent this morning. And that includes our hearing memorandum and our PowerPoint presentation as well.
I don't have those yet. I understand. I did. Ms. Walston did had mentioned that there were other materials that came in, and those are in the record. Your brief, I think that's 37. There were some clarifications which the staff had accepted. That was 38, and then there was a comment from the tribe, but that's separate. That's 39. So those are in the record. But otherwise the exhibits are numbered 1 through 36 before those three additional came in.
Okay, great. Yeah, it sounds like we've got everything in there. And just, you know, for purposes of clarity, we do have the hearing memorandum and the PowerPoint documents.
The PowerPoint, is that with the memorandum or should that be a separate document?
You know, that could probably be cataloged as a separate document.
Okay. We'll just mark that as 40 then.
Great.
And Ms. Walston ultimately is in charge of the numbering, so it could shift a little bit, but right now we'll just mark it as 40 in the PowerPoint.
Okay, great. Yeah, and just for clarity, you know, all of the exhibits that we added, even though it was an applicant submission, everything in there other than the hearing memorandum and the PowerPoint, and then there are two separate documents with some photos and captions. One is called Shoreline Access, and the other one is titled Rural Character. Those were created by the applicant just for reference for the examiner and members of the public. You know, we thought it would be helpful to include those. All the other documents are from the county's record, so the county can confirm that as well.
Yeah, and if they're already in the record, you do not need to resubmit those. But the Shoreline Access, that document would be 41 then, that's a separate one?
Well, those were actually the Shoreline. Let me see, the Rural Character exhibit and then the Shoreline Access exhibit. Those were in the list. They're early in the list.
I'm not quite sure. If they're in there, that's fine.
Okay. So those are actually not in the index list. Those were submitted by the applicant, but they haven't been introduced to the record. So that whole extra list of additional documents still needs to be admitted.
Okay. So just thanks for that clarification, Ms. Walston. So the Shoreline Access one, that'll be 41. And then the Rural Character document, that'll be 42.
Great. And then I think if we could just propose admitting all the other exhibits on our list now, you know, all of those are county documents. And really, we submitted those just so the examiner has a complete record of the application.
Okay, and that's fine. If they're already in the record, I don't want to have duplicates. It just makes, we already have a pretty voluminous record. And I know that the county did have, as like they had the, for example, the Shoreline Master Program that the applicant vested to, the Critical Areas Ordinance that was vested to, that sort of thing. So we've got those documents in there.
So if I could suggest, if Mr. Graham, if you want to like just read off the rest of the documents that you had on your list, and we can kind of number them as they go, because there's probably 15, I think.
Yeah.
That way we can capture them in the record.
So let me, I'll boot them up here, if you bear with me for one moment. Okay. So yeah, I'll start from the top here. So the first one is called Shoreline Access and Enjoyment Document. And that's the one with photos and captions.
Yep,
41.
Mm-hmm. Next one is rural character, which we just discussed as well. There's a stormwater supplemental information cover letter. Mm-hmm. It's a revised shoreline permit east outfall. Mm-hmm. Revised shoreline permit west outfall. Yeah. Revised conveyance modeling. Yep. The next one is called a vested code exhibit. Yep. The following is letter deferring request for 35-foot height variance. Mm-hmm. Next is proposed route of sound to Olympics Trail. Mm-hmm. Next, utility services to rural area memo. Mm-hmm. The next is the updated DAHP EIS comments. Yep. Next is shoreline permit graphics from Hackworth Group. Mm-hmm. The next document is titled Shoreline Permit. And I know that sounds similar to something the county submitted earlier, but it's actually a different document. There is a shoreline permit cover letter. Mm-hmm. Biological assessment alternative one. Mm-hmm. Biological assessment alternative two. Yep. Port Gamble JARPA is the next one. Yep. Next one is called Historic Artifacts with a date of January 2018. And I think that covers all of our exhibits.
Okay. Just finish getting, make sure I've got the numbers here. 8, so it looks like that would then add 42, we get up to 58. And Ms. Walston, we can coordinate as needed to make sure you ultimately, that you have everything, the record on this will be kept open for a bit so we can do that. But those are all admitted.
Okay. Thank you. And just one wayfinding note for the examiner, which may be helpful. The county's submission included three separate titles of the vested code. One was the Shoreline Master Program, one was Stormwater, and then one was the General Zoning Code. Right. And I think that will cover 99% of what the examiner may care to review. We submitted a separate document. It's a large document. It's 1,200 pages or so, but this is just an en masse submission of the vested version of the code, which includes other titles as well. And the reason we've done this is we thought in case there were any cross references in the few titles that we had provided to the examiner may want to refer to that other document. But again, this is just in the interest of completeness and it's all public record in any event.
Okay, and does that have an exhibit number that other?
I think Ms. Walston just assigned an exhibit number to it.
Okay.
So that's the vested code exhibit you're talking about?
Correct.
So that would be 47 if you're checking.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Gotcha.
Great.
Okay. And by zoning unit critical areas, 19B is the vested critical areas ordinance.
And oh, correct.
Okay, right. Gotcha. All right.
That's right. Yep. So if the examiner would like to consult the entire code, which, you know, kind of depends on how you go through it, right. We wanted to make that available to you.
Thank you.
Great. So I think really the key document at this point before we launch into our presentation would be the technical corrections document, which has been admitted as Exhibit 38. Mm-hmm. These are a series of, you know, some minor nits, some more significant corrections that we've discussed with county staff, and the county presenter already mentioned that the county agreed to all of these. Mm-hmm. So I think really the key documents that the examiner may care to reference would be the staff report along with those technical corrections.
Yep.
And I just wanted to note, you know, we have full agreement on all those, so that will of course simplify our hearing here. And that includes agreement on the conditions of approval for the project.
Okay, so that in terms of in the staff, I might as well go ahead and clarify that. So in terms of the staff report and the proposed conditions, the applicant does not have any concerns or further revisions other than what might be in this corrections memo.
That's correct. Yeah. So the only changes that we have to propose to any of the above are included in that Exhibit 38, which is called technical corrections.
Okay.
Great. Okay, well, I think we're ready to hop into our main presentation. You know, we did want to briefly highlight a few aspects of the project that are before the examiner. We've tried to set this up so that it supplements the county's presentation, just so we aren't duplicating information here. To start off, we thought it would be helpful for the examiner and also the members of the public watching to have the applicant's vice president, John Rose, provide some brief background and historical context for this project. Of course, this is an historic town, has a long and fascinating history, and we aren't going to go too much in depth, but our aim is really to provide some more context for, in particular, the SEPA alternatives analysis and also the design decisions that the examiner will see reflected in the applications. So Ms. Walston, I think, would you be the person to drive the PowerPoint, or is that something you can open up, or is that something that we should share on our side?
I can, if you'd like. You'd need to send that to me, but you should be able to share your screen and then you can have control over it. If technical issues happen, then I can always jump in, but you should be able to, and you have permissions, so.
Great, okay. Well, I will begin sharing here.
Okay.
There we go. So I'm hoping that's visible and large enough on everyone's screen.
That's coming in just fine.
Okay, great. Well, I will, for the initial part of our presentation here and to cover the first few slides, I think I'd like to hand it over to John Rose, who I believe is on the panel at this point.
Here.
Good morning. Mr. Rose, if you could state your name for the record.
John Rose.
And you swear to tell the truth under penalty of perjury under the laws of the state of Washington?
I do.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for this. This is a very technical project. And what we want to do is take a few minutes to fill in the context, and there's a lot in the code with this project that has to do with maintenance of character, public access, shoreline access, et cetera. And so we're not going to belabor the point, but I think it would be hard to really understand the project just with the technical review that we need to go through and the staff needs to go through. So Clayton, if you could, right before we go, there's an overview of the town. You can see all the grassy areas. You can see a flagpole, I guess, kind of middle left on the screen. And then you can see the mill site, which wraps around two sides of the town. And that picture right there with all the mill site and the lawn, that represents most of what is in the designated National Historic Landmark District. Not all of the project is in the National Historic Landmark District. So Clayton, if we could go to the next. The town was established in 1853, and the mill ran until it was closed and then dismantled in 1995. Removal of the mill really left the town in limbo because the town was just built to service the mill. And it really left us and left the company in just a very complicated position. It literally took us 25 years of work and investment to be able to get to this hearing today. Part of the journey included a trip to the Washington State Legislature. We actually added our own chapter to the GMA called National Historic Town. That's easy to find in the GMA code, but it really represents a collaborative effort between the company, between the legislature, and also the National Park Service, who weighed in heavily during the adoption of that chapter because they have seen too many historic places that don't have enough economic meaning to be commercially viable. And their admonishment, to legislators was that these historic places have to develop in order to survive. We have been on a 20-year environmental cleanup journey. The last leg of that will be completed in 2022. When the mill closed, we had about 50 buildings, many of them in questionable condition, perhaps in a different location. They would have not warranted reinvestment and might have been teardowns. All of the systems are aged. The sewers, storm systems all leaked. We had an obsolete sewer treatment plant, and there was no formal stormwater system, just like in so many historic towns around the country and around Puget Sound. And although we rent the homes and we have a wedding business, the town runs every single year at an operating loss between $250,000 and $350,000. That's painful. And so the company worked as fast as possible to get a repositioning plan. And unfortunately, that took 25 years. It's a very complicated site. Next, Clayton. This is the town around the 1940s, and you'll notice some real big differences compared to the photo we saw at the beginning. First, the mill site is covered with a massive mill structure. There is lumber stored all over the rest of the mill site, and you'll see that log rafting, which was quite common in Puget Sound up till about 10 years ago, up near the mill site, because the mill actually took logs in front directly from the water and then ran them through the mill operations. Next, Clayton, you could wave your cursor around the commercial area, the residential areas. And lastly, if you look off into the distance, you can see a farm. That is the historic Babcock Farm. Pope and Talbot, who founded the Puget Mill Company, were emigrated from Maine, East Machias, Maine. And they lobbied many of their friends and family to come out and work in Port Gamble. And one of them was the Babcocks. And the Babcocks operated that farm that provided the town dairy, produce, and oxen for logging. And that's a good representation of most of the land that's in our master plan. Next, please. The photo you just looked at prior to this showed, many hundreds of homes, but the photo we saw earlier really had a total of only about 50 buildings. This was set up as a traditional New England town. It was walkable. There were small lots, you could walk to services. And the reason was nobody owned an automobile in 1853. And so people had to live close to town. And so they lived in company housing because that was the only way they could reasonably get to work by the time the whistle blew. This was a very isolated location in 1853, and Port Gamble had to support itself, and it truly was cradle to grave. There was a hospital to be born in and a mortuary to be embalmed in. It's Kitsap's only a National Historic Landmark District. And from the get-go, it was a key contributor to Kitsap County's settlement, growth, and employment. Next, please. So touching on the cleanup, because it's such a big part of the story. There was cleanup all through the town, all through the mill site. There were four landfills on the shoreline that were remediated, underground storage tanks. The mortuary was one of the hottest areas that had the most sort of intense contamination levels. But by far, the biggest and most costly cleanup was the mill site and then dredging in Gamble Bay. We dredged about 110,000 yards of contaminated sediments out and replaced all those yards with clean sands. We pulled out about 8,600 creosote pilings. This is the biggest creosote piling cleanup in Puget Sound history. There were removed acres of over water construction, and then took and removed over half a mile of hard bank riprap and replaced it with much more habitat friendly stones. The company paid for 95% of this cleanup. The total will be over $40 million when we're done. The Washington State Department of Natural Resources did one small cleanup that was about $1 million cleanup. But otherwise, this was started with a voluntary cleanup program, and the company and now the successor company are seeing it through to the end. Next. So 50 historic buildings. Where did they go? Where did the rest of the buildings go? Well, as people began to purchase automobiles in the 1920s, they no longer had to live in company housing. They could pursue the American dream and drive to work every day. This is how the great American commute started. And it was also how many small towns got killed by the automobile. So literally, people moved out of town. They had their own homesteads, pursuing that dream. And as the homes became less utilized, many of them were taken away. In order to get people just coming back to town, we started a wedding and event business. It's one of the top event locations in Kitsap County. We have extended over 5 miles of pipe with the partnership of the PUD. So it has a very secure water system now. And then we and the Department of Ecology co-funded a brand new wastewater treatment plant. That wastewater treatment plant actually provides tertiary treatment and recycles the water and puts it back into the ground up in the hill behind town. But still, with all the improvements, the town loses over a quarter million dollars a year in operating revenue. Next, Clayton. In 2007, Pope Resources realized that North Kitsap was getting far too populated and suburbanized to continue operating as a commercial tree farm. And so we announced and made an offer to the public to partner with the public to buy as much of our 7,000 acres in North Kitsap as possible, with the goal of several things. One, creating a connected system of trails, both on the water and over land. To create open spaces that would be available for everybody as Kitsap grew. And to create the backbone for an enhanced economic development vision based on tourism and activities. And so it took 10 years. The company contributed about $1 million to that effort and piles of staff time. But when that effort ended in 2017, it resulted in the county owning 4,600 acres of once operating tree farm and 1.5 miles of shoreline. And you can see where Port Gamble now sits on top of the biggest county park that is in Puget Sound. But trail rides, hiking, equestrians that you can all do for free do not drive an economy. And so the development of Port Gamble is the way the county hopes to be able to monetize this tremendous outdoor attraction. And because otherwise there's no way to capture economically this benefit without having a place that actually generates and captures the revenue. And so Port Gamble is the representation of that. This is important to the county as they are fearful that someday they will lose Silverdale as their prime source of retail sales revenues. And while Port Gamble is certainly not going to replace Silverdale, that and several other efforts the county is making, it will be a start to letting the county be financially self-sufficient one day when Silverdale incorporates. And it's important context for everything we're going to talk about next. Okay, Clayton, thanks. This slide is just really helpful to talk about the order of magnitude and the relationship that Port Gamble, which is now going to have a visitor orientation, has to this tremendous public access of waterfront and trails. In fact, the county has raised about $3.5 million to develop a mountain bike ride park that's only going to be able to be accessed through Port Gamble. And they have also raised millions of dollars to construct a regional paved shared use pathway called the Sound to Olympics Trail. All of that terminates in Port Gamble. Next, Clayton. So what do you do when you have the chance to take over an ailing, beautiful, charming, but troubled historic town? Where do you go with it? How do you do planning besides subdividing and putting in trails? The first thing that we did was commit to some higher values that we did not want to violate in our effort to make the town more financially secure. First and foremost, inside the historic district, paramount is preserving and enhancing the historic New England character of Port Gamble. And it's not just historic character, it's historic New England. That's what represents the settlement pattern. People from back east arriving by water and then building a town that looked like their hometown so that their friends and family would feel comfortable making the 3,000 mile journey through the wilderness to get to a new life in Port Gamble. So if you go through Port Gamble, you will see more picket fences than any town in the world. And that was all intentional to be able to attract workers. New England architecture, the walkability, and we will have, as part of our design, the same density that Port Gamble had in the photos that you saw earlier. But the town is, the master plan is about almost 320 acres. Only about 120 acres is inside the historic district. So much of the project lies outside the historic district. In that area, we gave heavy focus to preserving the rural character of those lands. And the historians do not want us to make the project look like New England when we are outside of the historic district. That creates confusion, and it really waters down the impact of the district itself. So the focus is to clearly not be New England and to clearly preserve the rural character, including the historic farm that has been there since the 1850s. And that's key, and you'll see more of that as we talk. Second, Port Gamble is a treasure. It's a national treasure. It was recognized as one of the first properties to go into the registration system in the 1960s. We are not developing Port Gamble so that it is an exclusive place for high net worth people. We are sharing Port Gamble with the public to the maximum extent possible because the country has bestowed an honor on the town, and that honor needs to be shared. So as you go, as we go through this, you'll see that compared to back in the day when the mill was running, we have expanded community access by multiples. Lastly, the photos you saw showed Port Gamble in its heyday. It was a vital place. It was a noisy place. It was bustling. There was commerce. There was commuting to the ferry boat across the water to the Port Gamble Sklallam Reservation. There was just a din and roar with the mill site, and the place was not the quiet, retiring place that you see today. That's an anomaly in Port Gamble's history. And we want it to be vital so it thrives forever, so it never goes through a dark period like it has in the last 25 years, and so that it becomes economically viable and sustainable. And we're doing that by replacing the heavy industry with destination and visitor-oriented businesses. And in general, if you can switch, Clayton. We are leaving the industrial past for a greener, more people-oriented future. It was not the world's most welcoming place in 1945, and certainly the mill site wasn't a place you wandered down to enjoy the view. Next, Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Rose.
Just a few more, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So how do we preserve historic character? That sounds good, but how do you do it? Well, the Kitsap County Code has these town development objectives. It ensures the development maintains and enhances this historic character where it's appropriate. A great example is right below the text. That is the wedding and event pavilion that was built around 2010. We hired two historic architects to help design that, to make sure that this massing, the architecture, the roof lines, the presentation to the street, all met with a historic context. And that's gonna happen throughout the project. The general stores still there and viable. Those two buildings sit well together. In fact, most people have no idea that the pavilion is a modern building. Next, please. Rural character, a huge departure from the photo we just saw. The current residents include the Longhorn that is staring us down. That's a great picture of fields that will be preserved. There is over an acre of greenhouse that's there, has been used to raise seedlings for replanting in the timber industry. That greenhouse is going to be preserved. The vista at the very bottom shows the Port Gamble farm view looking down to town, and you can't see it from here because that flagpole is over a mile away. But besides fields and farms, there is a tremendous area of nearly old growth timber that is in back of town that is going to be completely preserved. There are trees with 4 to 5 foot diameter. There are trail systems that the public uses every day. All of that is going to be preserved for public use. And in order to do all of this preservation of fields and forest and vistas, the only way to do that is to do it through rural clustering, because the underlying zoning is 20 acre lots. So this 200 acres that isn't in the historic district, if we wanted to just follow the existing zoning, we would have 20 residential lots that would go to high net worth people and be privately owned. That would be a shame. And so what we did was use the clustering provisions in the performance-based development code and create clustering so that we can preserve and share 200 acres and the majority of 200 acres with the public. Next, please. So we talked about sharing more with the community. new shoreline access to the beach on the left. There is a bluff all around the trail, all along the bluff. That is actually going to connect to that mile and a half of shoreline that the county now owns. People will be able to rent kayaks. The mill site, as you can see, is going to be a lot more people friendly. And then we have parks in town that we hold events at, and thousands of people flock to every season. Next, please. Sustainability. This may be, I would posit it will be, the most sustainable historic town in Puget Sound. Historic towns, remember, weren't built with water quality. They weren't built with modern energy codes. And the first thing that we did was recycle 50 buildings, a portion of which would likely have been demolished in any other location. So we're reusing the buildings that are there. This town will have modern stormwater treatment. Even the state highway that's there will have modern stormwater treatment. The mill site that you saw with that huge mill on it never had stormwater. It direct discharged directly into the bay. Everything that is developed and everything that was existing is now going to be treated with water quality treatment. That new wastewater treatment plant took a sewer plant off the shoreline area. It built it in back of town, and it took a sewer pipe out of Hood Canal. It was one of the last sewer outfalls left in Hood Canal. In so doing, we opened up 90 acres for shellfish harvesting that are utilized both by the DNR and also local tribes can now resume shellfish harvesting that they couldn't before. The treatment is tertiary treatment. It's a membrane bioreactor where we actually produce effluent that is near the same quality as drinking water. And we and the owners of the new plant are actually working on a reuse project so that some of that water can be reused instead of just put back into the ground. Then lastly, our cleanup opened over 2 miles of Port Gamble Bay to shellfish harvesting where it had been closed for decades. Next. So what's the moral of the story? We're going to retain the best parts of Port Gamble and we're enhancing the rest. So as you look at the photo, and we've broken it down to these planning areas, look at the change that will happen on that mill site from the days of when Port Gamble and the mill was up and running. Number two is the beach on the north, which does not have a good access to it now, is going to be accessed both on the east and west and is going to be used by residents and visitors alike. In the town center, we will add more commercial properties and there will be more visitor accommodations like Airbnb. The residential zone is going to be filled back in the way you see in this photo. We're going to bring people back to this town to the same density you're looking at right now. The open spaces where all those old trees are and the trails is number five. And then lastly, the Port Gamble Agricultural District is gonna be enhanced with new growing. There will be a community supported farms. People will be able to enjoy the vistas from there. They will access the mountain bike ride park through that ag district. And there will be even more activities related to agriculture and agricultural tourism than there ever was in the past. So retaining the best and enhancing the rest. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Mr. Graham, was there anyone else from the applicant that you wanted to have? I think you had mentioned the a code person that would address code for you.
You know, I'm actually so I was referring to Mr. Rose, who's my co-presenter. Oh, okay. So he ran through most of the slides here. I've got a few slides which I'm happy to cover now.
Okay,
great. So I just wanted to note some of the materials that Mr. Rose referred to during the presentation included those rural character and the shoreline access photos that we addressed earlier. And there's also a map in the examiner's record that we mentioned with the Sound to Olympics Trail, at least the proposed location of that trail. So I just wanted to flag that for the examiner because Mr. Rose discussed it.
Okay.
Thanks to John for the background on the project. You know, we also want to acknowledge staff, very hard work, OPG and county staff together for the years-long effort that it really took to advance this project where we are today. The next few slides, actually our final few slides, address the formal approvals that are associated with the project, which are of course the most relevant to the examiner's review. So to hop into the next slide, I will start with where many land use proposals start, and that's SEPA. There was a years-long SEPA process for this project, which has been completed for both the applications before the examiner. As Mr. Smith mentioned, this included a full EIS on the project. This slide is a general side-by-side of the two main alternatives that were considered for the project. So here on alternative one, you've got just the general uses that are proposed here. New homes, new commercial, a hotel, a proposed site for West Sound Wildlife Shelter, full development of the mill site, which is what you see here on the northeast corner. Trails, bike paths, shoreline access, which we've mentioned earlier in the presentation, as well as some agritourism uses. Alternative two was different in a few respects, but really the key is if you look to the mill site here, right where my cursor is, there was a proposed conservation easement over a 16-acre swath of that mill site. This reduced the number of homes in the proposal, or at least in the second alternative, and there's fewer new commercial uses in that alternative. And I mentioned this side by side just because either alternative would be allowed under the current applications, but we've had a pretty exciting development on this project in that applicant has signed a purchase agreement in the interim to sell a conservation easement over this very portion of the mill site. So although either alternative is allowed under the approvals being sought, the development is going to look a lot more like alternative two once that conservation easement transaction closes. So the county issued the DEIS, public comments were received, the county responded to those public comments. The final EIS was published and was not appealed. So the final EIS for the project is in fact final. The only other thing I'd mention about the SEPA review for the project is it's really the basis for the comprehensive set of mitigation measures and the other conditions of approval that you see in the county staff report. So the examiner will see that this is a pretty robust package of public access and mitigation measures for the project build out. And it includes all the public benefits that Mr. Rose summarized for us. So this next slide shows the general metrics of the proposed development, and this ties into the uses that were proposed for the project from the prior slide. And I won't read these off, it's in the record if the examiner would like to refer to it, but the notable piece is this is a pretty low intensity development for a project of this size. The project site is close to 320 acres in area. There's extensive open space included. 160.85 acres is the figure of open space reserve that will be set aside. So, you know, you're looking at about half reserved open space. And the other important figure here is the 239 acres, which is devoted to green spaces. And that includes the 160 acre reserve for open space, but that also includes landscaped areas, parks, agricultural land, and the like. So in general, the proposal includes rural uses at rural development densities. And that's really key for the project because those rural densities are across the entire project, even though there are slightly more intense uses and densities in the Lammerd, which was mentioned earlier. And Lammerd, of course, stands for a limited area of more intense rural development. But again, it's all rural development. I did want to clarify something that was mentioned earlier on about the residential reserve. I think Mr. Smith mentioned this, but just so it's clear, there are 30 potential residential lots in this residential reserve area. Those lots will remain green space unless they're used to basically flex other residential units into that area. And the reason this was done is because we've got a town site with a very long history, and there's a substantial likelihood that cultural resources will be encountered as the development goes forward. So we, you know, as a proactive measure and in an abundance of caution, the applicant set aside this potential for 30 residential lots, which will only be used if we need to leave other areas undeveloped to preserve cultural resources. And another item I wanted to address is the letter from the Suquamish tribe, which I've actually just read on the fly here. I noticed that it raises some rural character concerns. So I wanted to take the opportunity to just respond to some of those concerns really briefly. So we've read the letter and we're aware of the authorities and the policies cited in the letter by the Suquamish tribe. You know, we acknowledge that rural character, that analysis can be pretty subjective under state law. We think it was adequately preserved in our proposal. You know, in fact, these policies and the legal authorities really guided the applicant's decisions that it made as the layout and design of the project was set up. So the rural character photos Mr. Rose discussed earlier are also helpful and relevant to the rural character and what measures have been taken to preserve rural character, in particular with reference to the residential cluster outside of the Lammerd. But we're of course happy to address any further questions on this issue, either from the examiner or from other community stakeholders, which of course includes the tribe. You know, we can probably discuss this at the close of the hearing, but we'd also be happy to provide a written response to the specific comments, which we could just file after the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Graham.
Right.
And just to note, the record will be kept open. So if there's anything additional the applicant wanted to submit, certainly that opportunity is available there.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't have any questions for the applicant at this point. So is there anything further, or can we open this up for public comment at this point?
Well, I've got a couple more slides, if I may.
Oh, okay,
that's totally fine. I did want to check with the examiner on the possibility of a written response. So we can bookmark that, but I'll get through our other two slides as quickly as possible. But
okay. There
were a couple other things we wanted to highlight here. So I appreciate it. So, you know, the next slide here flags the development approvals that are before the examiner. And again, we've been talking about a massive redevelopment project. We're talking about 15 plus years of build out. So the point of this slide is to bring us back to ground level and what approvals are before the examiner today. So we have a performance-based development plat or a PBD plat, and we have a shoreline substantial development permit, which we call an SSDP. As Mr. Smith mentioned, these applications are vested under the code in existence in 2013 when the application was made complete. And as the staff report mentioned, there is a development agreement that's being discussed with the county which would extend the vesting period, but these approvals standing on their own would be vested for a 5-year period if and when they're approved by the examiner. So again, the two key approvals before the examiner today are just the PBD plat and the SSDP. And the next slides briefly review the discretionary approval criteria. And of course, there are many code criteria that apply to these applications, but these are the key items that the examiner is to address. And we're flagging these because the code also requires findings that are specific to a lot of these criteria. So the PBD plat under the county code incorporates some pretty run-of-the-mill plat approval criteria, access, utilities, lot area, more run-of-the-mill items like that. But the performance-based development aspect of it also introduces some more discretionary items that the examiners to review. And we've highlighted some of them in this slide. But really key to keep in mind is these are general health, safety, and welfare factors. The examiners to consider compatibility with surrounding uses, public benefits, consistency with the code, et cetera. Staff's review of these criteria took into account, of course, the public benefits, the access and mitigation package that was discussed earlier. And there's also a pretty thorough compatibility and impacts analysis in the EIS, all of which fed through into the conditions of approval. So the staff's findings on the criteria shown in this slide are on pages 64 and 65 of the staff report. And the only other thing that I would note about the PBD plat is it subsumes another director decision, which is the decision Mr. Smith mentioned about the parking standards for the development. This is really an administrative level decision that was made as part of the PBD plat. And it allows certain types of parking to be counted, namely alley loaded garage parking as part of the minimum parking for the development. And again, we did this just to be sensitive to the historic context of the project. You know, we want this to look, we want the redevelopment to be historically appropriate, and cars just weren't part of that initial development. So we've used these strategies to, you know, be sensitive to those considerations while also getting adequate parking. So to hop to the next slide here, the shoreline substantial development permit. This slide is not too detailed, but these are the three high level criteria for SSDP issuance by the county, basically. It's the Shoreline Management Act, which is a state level mandate, the county shoreline master program, and then other applicable county regulations. And that seems pretty straightforward, but it's actually a great deal of content. Each source contains many different policies, regulatory mandates that need to be meticulously reviewed by someone, and that someone in this case was county staff. So as Mr. Heacock mentioned, you know, there's a very meticulous review of these factors. The county staff found compliance with all of these criteria. So, we believe that the record supports consistency with SSDP criteria and that it justifies issuance of the permit here. And if the examiner would like to look to the staff report, there's a pretty large part of the staff report between pages 48 and 62 that address each of these criteria pretty exhaustively. So in general, the applicant concurs with staff's findings of consistency for both approvals. It's not really a surprise. This was a years-long iterative design process that was followed with county staff and stakeholders, other members of the public. And our goal from day one, and again, I've personally been working on this project for over a decade myself, but the main goal was to ensure consistency with all of the above policies, regulations, et cetera. So I feel that the applicant has done a good job of this. This brings us to our final slide. And really this is just to flag to the examiner again that there's a staff report recommending approval, but we also have a technical corrections document that's relevant that should be reviewed side by side. Some of the technical corrections were to the conditions of approval, but others affected other parts of the staff report, including recitation of, you know, background facts and applicable policies, et cetera. So we would just ask that the examiner consider the technical corrections and include them in any associated findings or conclusions, in addition to the couple changes to the conditions of approval. So that's our request, and that concludes my presentation. Unless there were further questions at this point, I think we can go on to the next section of the hearing here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Graham. So at this point, we'll open this up for public comment. Ms. Wilson, do we have a list of individuals who have signed up to testify?
I do not, okay. And actually the way it will work is if anyone can, like I said, click the raise your hand icon so I can see, or if you're calling in by phone and you'd like to speak, hitting *9 works as well. The other thing I can do is I can go through and just briefly unmute each attendee, double check that they're not being skipped over, that they don't want to testify, and then we can do it that way, because I don't have a universal unmute, unfortunately.
Oh, you don't have me. Okay. I'm wondering if, since you don't have a universal unmute, I wonder if we should click on everyone just to make sure we don't miss anyone.
Yeah, it's no problem. It just takes me a second.
Unmute everyone, but okay. Yeah, let's, why don't we just run through and see who's on there who wants to testify and do it that way. It looks like we have potentially a fair number who wish to speak, and it's kind of hard to tell because I don't know if everyone who's signed, who I see up here on my screen, wants to speak or not. But I'm going to limit comment to about 3 minutes, just to ensure we keep this on track. Okay. Yeah, Ms. Wilson, if you can go ahead and start with the first person, and we'll just run through. And if you wish to speak, please do so. And if you don't wish to, that's fine as well. Either approach.
Okay, so I'm going to start at the top, and that's going to be two of our two callers. Okay. So the first caller, if you'd like to speak, you are able to unmute. Not, I will move you back over. And the second caller, if you have comment. Oh, we go back to the first caller here, just 1 second. Okay, so caller with the last 4 digits of the number ending in 525. Oh, there we go. I think you should be unmuted now.
Yeah, I don't need to say anything, but thank you so much.
Oh, okay. All right. And Gilbert, you're able to unmute if you'd like. Okay. Mr. Fuhr.
Mr. Furry is actually on our project team, so he'll stay on, but won't hop in quite yet.
Okay.
All right. I've got a Bo Willard.
Also on the project team.
Okay. Brenda Brown.
Also on our project team. We're here in force, apparently.
And I know Mr. Droz also on the team. I've got, I'm not sure who I've got, Daly maybe? Okay. And I know Ms. Pitcher, about Mr. Maynard?
He's on our project team.
Okay. Smith. Datisman?
Also.
Campbell?
Not sure about that one.
Mr. Campbell?
Oh, also with us, I believe, unless it's another John Campbell.
Okay. Mr. Sled? Okay. I've got looks like a Lisa Rose. Mr. Sullivan? Mr. Wirt? Nettleton? Timmermans? I believe Ms. Foster is with your group as well. How about Ms. Brooks? And Wageman? All right.
Also with our team.
Okay, that is everybody on the list then. So I didn't have no takers.
It looks like there is no one online who wishes to comment. If somehow we've missed someone, we are keeping the record open. And also, if you have access to the chat function, you can go ahead and flag that and let us know that you're out there and wish to provide comment on the proposal. And we'll keep an eye on that for a little bit until we adjourn here. So there were no comments at this point. It's been a very thorough review. The record's very thorough, and I have a thorough staff report. But is there anything else that the applicant wanted to address today before we adjourn?
I believe that that covers everything. The only items on my punch list were, you know, to offer a specific response to the letter from the Suquamish tribe. And then, you know, I think we have a pretty good idea of all the documents in the record, but if there's any opportunity to review the exhibits as finally, you know, marked, or maybe an updated index, and at least have the opportunity for the county and applicant to comment on that, we'd appreciate that as well.
Yeah. So I'll keep the record open initially for probably a week, unless the applicant needs more time. Probably not, but if I know the holidays are coming up, so if you need it, whether it's a week or two, it doesn't matter from my perspective. But then if comments do come in and there's additional material that the applicant wishes to address, typically what I do is just if the applicant can just request additional time to address that comment, because I know sometimes there's an opportunity to address something if it comes in early, but if something comes in, you know, close to business on the last day, raises a new issue, then out of fairness, I think the applicant needs to be afforded an ability to address that comment. So that's typically how I approach that. So is a week sufficient for the additional, I think that there was a response to the Suquamish tribe's comment the applicant wanted to present. Would a week, keeping the record open for a week, be sufficient?
Yeah, I think that would be plenty of time.
Okay, so that's December 24th, 5 p.m. Hopefully you all aren't working that late, but that would go to Ms. Walston, and then she will forward that on to me. Ms. Walston does maintain the record and the number 8 exhibit, so forth. So she will pull all that together and provide an updated index with everything. So please coordinate with her on that in case there are any questions or anything that needs to be corrected or somehow we didn't capture everything. Right now, as noted earlier, we've got 1 through 58. I guess 59 probably would be, it sounds like, if the, oh, actually, no, we already accounted for that. I think that was 39. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. So I think that's it. Are there any procedural questions? Is there anything further that I need to address before we adjourn?
No, ma'am. I think that covers everything on my punch list.
Okay. Ms. Walston, is there anything else that I need to address? I don't see anyone else on the chat that indicated that they're out there and somehow we skipped over them. So,
no, I think we are covered.
Okay. So as noted, the record's kept open for a week, and that, of course, is open to the applicant, citizens, and the county. And then a written decision will be out within 10 business days of the close of the record next week. And I think that's all. Thank you all for your efficient presentation. And it was very interesting to hear the history and background on this proposal. So I appreciate the thought that went into the presentation from both the planning department and the applicant. So thank you all.
Sure.
We are adjourned.
Okay.